to deal with a number of eternal issues that confront us in life. So in the course of the novel, we meet an apostate clergyman, one of the favorite targets of Lewis and many of his writings, who holds honest opinions fearlessly expressed. And Lewis points out that while he pays a great price for honesty, that he also sells wrathful books and gets rich and is rewarded with a bishopric in the Church of England for his heretical views. And you meet a cynical ghost, a woman who wears her feelings on her shoulders and cries out, a flirtatious female who's tried to vamp men most of her life, an artist who is preoccupied with art for art's sake, an ambitious wife wanting her husband to advance, a possessive mother, a man dominated by lust, a tragedian intent on making his wife miserable. And what he does, he uses a device of personification. He takes certain aspects of human character, he personifies it, puts it in a little vignette, sets it before you, and bang, you know, he just pops your life down here, time and time and time again. So, it is not the best of the works, but it's very good. And the at each series along the route through the book, each person is having to make a choice between heaven and hell. And he says, when you finally end up eternally in heaven or hell, you will discover that earth was the beginning of hell or the beginning of heaven, but that in fact our eternal destinies are made up of a series of small choices over a long period of time. And to move across the barrier at the end is simply to put our signature on a contract and then negotiate for most of our lives. Now, I want to give you a feel for just one of his favorite targets. So if you want to put these down and look at it sometime, it's page 35 following, where George MacDonald and the narrator of the book meet this fellow, and he sees he's a fat ghost with a cultured voice who spoke to him on the bus. He seemed to be wearing gaiters. Well, he discovers as they begin to talk that this, in fact, is a clergyman who had been a school chum of his. So he says, "Ah, Dick, I shall never forget some of our talks. I expect you've changed your views a bit since then." This is the clergyman speaking. "You became rather narrow-minded towards the end of your life, but no doubt you've broadened out now." "How do you mean?" "Well, it's obvious now, isn't it, that you weren't quite right. Why, my dear boy, you were coming to believe in a literal heaven and hell." "But wasn't I right?" "Oh, in a spiritual sense, to be sure. I still believe in them that way. I am still, my dear boy, looking for the kingdom. But nothing superstitious or mythological." "Ah, I see. You mean that the great town, with its continual hope of morning, with its field for indefinite progress, is in a sense heaven, if you only have the eyes to see it? That is a beautiful idea." "I didn't mean that at all. Is it possible that you don't know where you've been? Now that you mention it, I don't think we ever do get it ready. What do you call it?" "We call it hell." "There's no need to be profane here, my dear boy. I may not be very orthodox in your sense of that word, but I do feel that these matters ought to be discussed simply, seriously, and reverently." "Discuss hell reverently?" "I meant what I said. You have been in hell. Though if you don't go back, you may call it purgatory." "Go on, my dear boy, go on. That is so like you. No doubt you'll tell me why, on your view, I'm a sinner. I am not angry. But don't you know? You were sent there because you are an apostate. Are you serious, dear?" "Perfect. This is worse than I expected. Do you really think that people are penalized for their honest opinions? Even assuming, for the sake of argument, that those opinions were mistaken. Do you really think there are no sins of intellect?" "There are indeed, Dick, but there is high ground prejudice and intellectual dishonesty and timidity and stagnation. But honest opinions fearlessly follow. they are not sinners. Well, he then goes on and gives some examples of ideas. When the doctrine of the resurrection ceased to commend itself to the critical faculties which God had given me, I openly rejected it. I preached my famous sermon. I defied the whole chapter. I took every risk. What risk? What was it all likely to come of it except what actually came? Popularity, sale for the books, invitations, and finally bishopric. Dick, this is unworthy of you. What are you suggesting? Friend, I'm not suggesting at all. You see, I know now. Let us be frank. Our opinions were not honestly come by. We simply found ourselves in contact with a certain current of ideas and plunged into it because it seemed modern and successful. Applying the spirit of the age. At college, you know, we just started automatically writing the kind of essays that got good marks and saying the kinds of things that get applause. When in our whole lives did we ever honestly face in solitude the one question on which it all turned? Whether, after all, the supernatural might not, in fact, occur? When did we put up one moment's real resistance to the loss of our faith? Now, if this is meant to be a sketch of Genesis liberal theology, I reply that it is more a mere libel. Do you suggest that men like... And so it goes. Well, coming on down further, he says, in response to his claim again, that these were all very honest opinions, sincerely expressed. The accompanying ghost says, of course, having allowed oneself to drift, unresisted, unprotected, accepting every half-conscious solicitation from our desires, we reached a point where we no longer believed the faith. Just in the same way a jealous man, drifting and unresisting, reaches a point at which he believes lies about his best friend. A drunkard reaches a point at which, for the moment, he actually believes another glass will do him no harm. The beliefs are sincere in the sense that they do occur as psychological events in man's mind. If that's what you mean by sincerity, they are sincere. And so are ours. But errors which are sincere in that sense are not innocent. Well, this is extremely interesting, said the Episcopal ghost. It's a point of view, and certainly it's a point of view. In the meantime, but there is no meantime, said the other, all that is over. We are not playing now. And I've come a long journey to meet you. You have seen hell. You are now inside of heaven. Will you even now repent and believe? I'm not sure that I've got the exact point you're trying to make, said the Episcopal ghost. I'm not trying to make any point, said the Spirit. I'm telling you to repent and believe. But, my dear boy, I believe already. We may not be perfect. Agreed, but you completely misjudge me if you do not realize that my religion is a very real and a very gracious thing to me. Well, that's back to life. Now, that brings me to the space novels, and I will say just a few words about mine. Walk in any airport bookstore almost in the world and find this series of books. Out of the Silent Planet, Paralandia, and That Hideous Strait. I was going to read a few excerpts, but time is a little later than I meant it to be. And I won't take time to do that. But these are generally regarded as among classic expressions of the space novel. They are superbly crafted literature, just from the standpoint of literature. If you want it, just a brand new good adventure, you can have it with these novels. But on the other hand, they are also very thinly disguised mythological apologies. The literary genre is mythology. And these are addressed specifically, much as The Great Divorce, for the most part, to the romantic longings of man. And Lewis uses a device in which he takes us out of our own world so that that in looking back on it, we see things we would not have seen if we'd stayed in our own world. The first of these takes place on the planet Mars, a place called Mount Cameron. It is an unfallen planet where there are some supernatural beings who have intercourse immediately, directly with the natural beings of the planet. There is a combination of a scientist technocrat and a greedy adventurer, two characters called Weston and Vine, who kidnap a Cambridge philologist by the name of Rance. Now, if you know Lewis's love affair with words, that's easy to find why he's a Cambridge philologist, right? But they take him back to Mars with under the mistaken impression that the gods of that planet demand a sacrifice. But since the planet has not fallen, they have no desire for that. Well, anyway, it's a bang-up good adventure in which Ransom contends with his captors and tries to keep the planet from being corrupted by sin. And in fact, since it's not fallen, they really can't talk about sin or evil. The closest they can come to that is just talking about being bent, a little bit out of shape. The second volume is, in my judgment, by far the best of three, and it is one of the most hauntingly eloquent pieces of work in literature. It is a story, it is a re-mythologization of the story of Paradise, the Garden of Eden, and the Fall. Ransom is taken to Venus, which is basically a fluid. That is, it's a vast sea. And it has a good many floating islands that are some depth of vegetation, but they undulate with the waves of the sea, so that everything is constant motion. And if you're on one of these floating islands, you never know where you're going to be the next day. There's only one fixed point on the planet, and it's called the fixed island. It is permissible for the king and the queen, who are the only inhabitants of Venus, to visit the fixed island during the daytime. But they cannot remain there overnight. They've got to return to the floating islands. So, what happens here is that you have a reenactment of temptation and the fall. Weston has now become a figure that Lewis calls the unmanned. So, Ransom is transported to Venus by supernatural forces in order to be the representative of God in the battle that's about to take place. Weston lands in his spaceship, and he now comes in the form of the tempter to try to get the queen of the island, of the planet, the Green Lady, to sin. Now, a great deal of dialogue and this very powerful spiritual insight takes place in the course of this novel. It's filled with enormous symbolism and dimensions. In my judgment, it is the most powerful retelling of the story of the fall that I think probably has been done. I think perhaps Milton's Paradise Lost is the only thing that would be comparable quite to. You have here a powerful symbol for sin, in that the king and the queen, if they are related to God, have to commit their tomorrows to God. That is, they cannot take tomorrow into their own hands, which is what they would do if they remained on a fixed island, so they would know where they are tomorrow. So that's the great prohibition. And the other man is trying to get them to stay on the fixed island. Well, it gets into a rising series of adventures through subterranean caverns and a bunch of things. And finally, it leads, when Ransom escapes with the king and the queen, to the surface of the planet again on a fixed island. It leads to an almost apocalyptic scene of praise to God that is one of the most eloquent pieces of literature that I know anywhere. That is absolutely a must. And If you never give it to anybody outside the church, you ought to know that yourself. And once you do, I think your perception of God and world and fall and human existence will be permanently altered. The third of these is probably the least successful. No question, it's the least successful. It had very critical reaction. It's a good book. But Lewis here tends to be a little heavy-handed. And what you have here is a reconstruction of Arthurian myth in modern-day England. Ransom comes back, and he becomes one of the figures out of the myth of Arthur. And without going into a lot of this, you have a great confrontation between a scientific, bureaucratic, technological combine called the NICE, the National Institute for Coordinated Experiments, that is trying to take over the world and, in fact, launch interplanetary, not pioneering, but colonization. And he takes a good many swipes at his favorite enemies. The problem, I think, in the book is that the satire is too sharp, and when you feel the slash, you don't want to laugh, you really bleed a lot. And it doesn't have quite the sophisticated touch that some others do, but you'll find some great things in terms of a lot of the problems the church has to face today. It's, I think, a very super kind of thing. Now, what was he doing in these space novels? I want to pick up if I can find it. What was he trying to accomplish in these? And I want to reconstruct the end of that hideous strength where he really clues us into his apologetic purpose. Some people say, well, these are super good stories, you know, but they're not apologetics. And Lewis puts it this way at the end of that hideous strength. Why he tells this tale of fiction. It was Dr. Ransom who first saw that our only chance was to publish in the form of fiction what would certainly not be listened to as fact. He even thought, greatly overrating my literary powers, that this might have the incidental advantage of reaching a wider public. And that certainly it would reach a great many people sooner than Wesley, a mad scientist. To my objection that if accepted as fiction, it would for that very reason be regarded as false, he replied that there would be indications enough in the narrative for the few readers, the very few, who at present were prepared to go further in the matter. And they, he said, will easily find out you or me, or will easily identify Wesley. Anyway, he continued, what we need for the moment is not so much a body of belief as a body of people familiarized with certain ideas. If we could even effect in 1% of our readers a changeover from the conception of space to the conception of heaven, we should have made the book. Well, I think those books do serve that kind of purpose. They are very, very powerful. Okay, that brings me now to the final discussion of, I guess, one of my favorites of books. The Children's Stories, the Narnia series. Now, how many of you said you had seen some of them? Has anybody read all of the Narnia series? Do you like the best book? Susan? Well, the Narnia series is it's just a romping good fairy tale set in another dimension. Narnia is another land that is not within the universe. It's another dimension within the universe. And people pass back and forth in and out of time cycles so that, in fact, you move through two generations of Earth children, you're introduced in the stories, through the whole creation to consummation cycle of the land of Narnia. And it allows Lewis not only to tell some very good stories that can be enjoyed simply as literature, but it also allows him to see the ground of imagination in the life of a modern child and hope that they will be drawn to the key symbols within stories. You don't ever have anything quite direct in terms of symbolism with persons and the Bible, but it's very close. In fact, one of the criticisms you can make is that the parallel is so close that it is almost allegory and not really quite classic myth. Because in myth, you don't know exactly what the symbol stands for. In allegory, you do. But a lot of what you see here in the land of Narnia depends upon what kind of person you are, says Lewis. And it's a fantastic place. Great lion prances around as soon as he saw it. The stars and sun appear, grass and flowers begin to sprout. The grassy land bubbles like water. The pot pouring out great hunks of earth that turn into animals and trees, and pairs are selected from the animals, and life begins, and a loud voice cries out, "Narnia, Narnia, Narnia. Awake, love, think, speak, be walking trees, be talking beasts, be divine waters." And the animals begin to talk, the trees begin to walk, and you're into the classic fairy tale setting. Now, what is it? Well, there are some people who look at a lion and see nothing more than a lion. There are others who look at a lion and see nothing else. And in fact, there are people who had chances to see, and they could not see any miracle of voice and locomotion at all. All they could see was a world of nature and hear the roar of a lion. And so about the Narnia stories, as well as about creation that I suggested, Lewis said, "What you see and hear depends a good deal on where you are standing. It also depends on what sort of person you are." Now, a lot of people read these just great fairy tales. But there are others who find a far, far deeper meaning. You may be surprised to know that Lewis is widely regarded as among the half dozen finest children's authors of the 20th century. In fact, there is no question that the Narnia series will remain a classic of English literature from now until the end. You can go anywhere now in the Western world, and the Narnia series sells and grows. I was lecturing on Lewis at Washington State University last spring. The bookstore there had 70 copies of the Narnia sets, the Narnia stories, on display. And that's unreal. So, what you have here is a chronological tale. The titles are like these: The Magician's Nephew, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Horse and His Boy, Prince Caspian, The Voyage of the Dog Trainer, The Silver Chair, and The Last Battle. Now, I mean, you want to read them when you just hear the titles and stories, you know. And what he does is to take you out of your own world again, but not like in space novels where you go somewhere else in the universe, but now he takes you into another dimension. So that seeing life from another angle, from another perspective, lets you see things you've never seen before. There's no time correlation. The two generations of kids, they move back and forth by a series of magical devices. Magic rings, magic wardrobe, a picture of a ship hanging on a wall, a hole in a schoolyard wall, a railway platform, and so on. And what great memories. In the story, you meet Diggory. Who wouldn't want to go to Polly, Peter, Eddie, Lucy, Susan, Eustace, and Jill. And when they go to Narnia, they are kings and queens of Narnia. And every time Narnia gets in trouble, Aslan calls them back to Narnia to help them. So you have these smashing great battles and all kind of intrigue and evil, all kinds of things going on. And the series of investors is really exciting, and I don't have time to take you into that, but you encounter so many fascinating couples: Calum, Arkenland, the Island of Darkness, the Island of Death, Telmar, the Giant City, Underland, and these three dashing Narnian kings, Caspian, Rillian, and Tyrion, and some of the most unforgettable characters now in English literature: Mr. Tumnus the Fall, Trumpkin the Dwarf, Jobbis the White Witch, Reepicheep, the valiant mouse, puddle blown the marsh weed, strawberry the calf horse, the monopod, shift the ape, puzzle the dolphin, jewel the unicorn. And flitting in and out in the pages of fogs and satyrs and centaurs and dwarfs and giants and talking beasts and walking trees and gods and goddesses of the woods and the rivers and the trees. And here you really encounter life. The noble, the terrified, the enchanting, the wonder, pleasure, self-sacrifice, honor, duty, courtesy, killing, hate, destruction, the stuff that really makes up existence as we encounter it. Some people say, oh, you got too much blood in the stories. Lewis says the blood is part of life, the children of the world. But above all, there's Aslan the Lion, the creator, the consolator, the redeemer of Narnia. And he's a lion. You can't ever mistake that, but he's really more than a lion. He is the imposing presence of Narnia. With a roar, he can make the whole land of Narnia tremble. He is not tamed by it. He will allow the children on occasion to come up and run their hands through his mane, but they must never presume upon Aslan. He's a terrifying, loving presence in the middle of Narnia. And he can say, as a mere matter of fact, I have swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realm. Well, what do kids get out of it? Politics? Maybe, maybe not. Lewis said that no book is worth reading when you're a child than that is not worth reading and usually far more worth reading when you become an adult. And I contended in my work on Lewis, my book on Lewis, that probably many children didn't find more than fairy tales, but that I hope that he was salting childhood imagination and that the encounter with joy zings it. Would at some point draw them back again to Narnia tales, and the key, the mystery, would be disclosed. I've had several letters at times from teachers. One lady I recall a few years ago in Alabama, who read my book, and said, I thought you'd just be very interested to know, but I read this to my fourth grade class every year, just before Easter. One of the Aslan stories I'll read to you. And she said, almost always, I've had experience that when I finish the story of Kevin and Aslan, a child will raise their hand and say, well, Miss so-and-so, that really sounds an awful lot like Jesus, doesn't it? And she said, you may be a little bit cynical about how much depth of understanding can come with a child in mind. Well, whether it does or not, I do think that we're drawn back. And I think that modern child is child modern man. And to awaken to emotion, feeling, passion, the whole realm of imagination is a great service that Lewis does for us all. Well, I want to read for you just a couple of excerpts. One of the really powerful statements on the on conversion is a classic treatment of the conversion of Eustace from a lion, from a dragon, back into a little boy. And a good deal of this voyage of Dogcutter is centered around Eustace. Now, Eustace is not your kind of all-American kid. He's really a his opponent. And he starts the book off. I mean, when you read two sentences in this particular novel, you're hooked. You can't let it go. There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. His parents called him Eustace Clarence, and the schoolmasters called him Scrub. I can't tell you how his friends spoke to him, for he had none. He didn't call his father and mother, but Harold and Alberta. They were very up-to-date and advanced. They were vegetarians, non-smokers, and teetotalers, and wore a special kind of underclothes. In their house, there was very little furniture, and very few clothes on the beds, and the windows were always open. Eustace Clarence liked animals, especially beetles, if they were dead in their car. He liked books, if they were books on information, and had pictures of grain elevators for a fat, poor children doing exercises in modern schools. And so he goes, well, I mean, this kid's really some kind of kid. And so what happens is that he gets turned into a dragon, because on the voyage of dog travel, they stop at an island, and there's a cave where a big horned gold is protected by a dragon. So Eustace goes in and tries to get the gold, and gets that, the dragon turns into a dragon. So the problem that you have to face is, how do you get undragoned from Eustace's voyage? And it is a marvelous treatment of Christian conversion. I'll tell you, the problem is, it's so late, I don't have time to read it. It is powerful, powerful stuff. And it is the best metaphor that C.S. Lewis has for what it means to be converted. Would you want to hear this on type tag? All right, let me talk about it. I've got some of this marked where I can do some skipping. Dragon, when that thing was really constricted. And so he's trying to signal somebody about the fact that he's a dragon and he'd like to try to get undragoned. Well, it finally happens, and then he comes back to the campfire where all the kids are gathered around, and he engages them now again as a boy, and he tries to tell them what's happened. And he says, I won't tell you how I became a dragon till I could tell the others and get it all over, said Eustace. By the way, I didn't even know it was a dragon until I heard you all using the word when I turned up here the other morning. I want to tell you how I stopped being one. Fire ahead, said Edward. Well, last night I was more miserable than ever. And that beastly arm ring was hurting like anything. Is that all right now? Eustace laughed. A different laugh from any Edmund had ever heard him give before, and slipped the bracelet easily off his arm. There it is, he said. And anyone who likes it can have it, as far as I'm concerned. Well, as I was saying, I was laying awake and wondering what on earth would become of me. And then, but mind you, it may have been a dream. I don't know. Go on, said Edwin, with considerable patience. Well, anyway, I looked up and saw the very last thing I expected. A huge lion coming toward me. And one queer thing was that there was no moon last night. But there was moonlight over the lion. So it came nearer and nearer. I was terribly afraid of it. You may think that being a dragon, I could have knocked any lion out easily enough. But it wasn't that kind of fear. I wasn't afraid of it eating me. I was just afraid of it, if you can understand. Well, it came closer to me and looked straight into my eyes. And I shut my eyes tight, but that wasn't any good, because it told me to follow it. You mean it spoke? I don't know, now that you mention it. I don't think it did, but it told me all the same. And I knew I'd have to do what it told me, so I got up and followed it. And it led me a long way into the mountains. And there was always this moonlight over and around the lion wherever we went. So at last we came to the top of the mountain I'd never seen before. And on the top of this mountain there was a garden, with trees and fruit and everything. In the middle of it, there was a well. I knew it was a well because you could see the water bubbling up from the bottom of it. But it was a lot bigger than most wells. Like a very big round bath with marble steps going down into it. The water was as clear as anything, and I thought if I could just get in there and bathe, it would ease the pain in my leg. The lion told me I must undress first. Mind you, I don't know if he said any words out loud enough. I was just going to say that I couldn't undress because I hadn't any clothes on, when I suddenly thought that dragons are snaky sorts of things, and snakes can cast off their skins. Oh, of course, thought I. That's what the lion means. So I started scratching myself, and my scales began coming off all over the place. And then I scratched a little deeper, and instead of just scales coming off here and there, my whole skin started peeling off beautifully, like it does after an illness, or as if I was a banana. In a minute or two, I just stepped out. I could see it lying there beside me, looking rather nasty. It was a most lovely feeling. So I started to go down into the well for my bath. But just as I was going to put my foot into the water, I looked down and saw that it was all hard, rough, and wrinkled, and scaly.
just as before. Oh, that's all right, said I. It only means I had another smaller suit underneath the other one. And I'll have to get out of it, too. So I scratched and tore again, and this thunderstorm peeled off beautifully. And out I stepped and left it lying beside the other one and went down to the well for my bath. Well, exactly the same thing happened again. I thought to myself, oh dear, however many skins have I got to take off? For I was longing to bathe my leg, so I scratched away for the third time and got off the third skin just like the two others and stepped out again. But as soon as I looked at myself in the water, I knew it had been no good. Then the lion said, but I don't know if it spoke. You will have to let me undress you. I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you. But I was pretty nearly desperate now. So I just lay down flat on my back to let him do it. The very first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right in the mouth. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I'd ever felt. The only thing that made me able to bear it was just the pleasure of feeling the stuff peel off. You know, if you've ever picked the scab of a sore place, it hurts like billfish. Oh, but it is such fun to see it come to life. I know exactly what you mean, said he. Well, he peeled the beastly stuff right off, just as I thought I'd done to myself the other three times. Only they hadn't hurt it. And there it was, lying on the grass, only ever so much thicker, darker, and more knobbly looking than the others had been. And there was I, smooth and soft as a peeled switch, and smaller than I'd been. Then he caught hold of me. I didn't like it much, for I was very tender underneath now, but I had no skin. And he threw me into the water. It smarted like anything, but only for a moment. After that, it became perfectly delicious, and as soon as I started swimming and splashing, I found that all the pain had gone from my arm. And then I saw why. I turned into a boy again. You'd think me simply phony if I told you how I felt about my own arms. I know they have no muscle and are pretty moldy compared with cast wounds, but I was so glad to see them. After a bit, the lion took me out and dressed me. Dressed you? With his paws? Well, I don't exactly remember that bit, but he did somehow, brother, in new clothes. The same I've got on now, as a matter of fact. And then suddenly I was back here, which is what makes me think it must have been a dream. No, it wasn't a dream, said Edmund. Why not? Well, there are clothes for one thing, and you have been, well, undragged for another. What do you think it was, then? Asked Eustace. I think you've seen Aswell, said it. Well, the crucifixion of Aswell is one of the most moving pieces of literature I think ever to be committed to the page. I wish I had time to read it to you. I didn't want to give you the closing part of this Voyage of Don Quixote. It'll take just about 2 minutes. Because that becomes the key to the whole Martin series. They're on the Dawn Traverse, the ship going to the very end of the world. And the water gets shallower and shallower and shallower, and finally, there's so many flowers and vegetation, they finally have to get out and begin to walk. And as they walk, they begin to see on the horizon there's some kind of a strange object. Something so white on the green grass that even with their eagle's eyes they could hardly look at it. They came on and saw that it was a lamb. Come and have breakfast, said the lamb in its sweet, milky voice. Then they noticed for the first time that there was a fire lit on the grass and fish roasting on it. They sat down and ate the fish, hungry now for the first time for many days. And it was the most delicious food they had ever tasted. Please, lamb, said Lucy, is this the way to Aslan's country? Not for you, said the lamb. For you, the door into Aslan's country is from your own world. What, said Edmund, is there a way into Aslan's country from our world, too? I have to tell you that there is a shattered piece of wiretap very close to the fire of the fish river. And suddenly, a voice comes from the land. There is a way into my company from all of the worlds. But as the Lamb spoke, his snowy white flushed from the tawny gold, and his size changed, and he was Aslan himself, towering above him and scattering light from his brain. "Oh, Aslan," said Lucifer, "will you tell us how to get into your country from our world?" "I shall be telling you all the time," said Aslan. "But I will not tell you how long or short the way will be, only that it lies across a river. But do not fear that, for I am the great bridge builder. And now come, I will open the door into the sky and send you on into your own land." "Please, Aslan," said Lucy, "before we go, will you tell us when we can come back to Narnia?" "Please, and oh, do make it soon." "Dearest," said Aslan very gently, "you and your brother will never come back to Narnia." "Oh, Aslan," said Edna and Lucy, both together in despairing voices. "You are too old, children," said Aslan, "and you must begin to come close in your old world now." "It isn't Narnia, you know," sobbed Lucy. It's you. We shan't meet you there. And how can we live and never meet you?" "But you shall meet me there, dear one," said Aslan. Are you there too, sir?" said Edward. "I am," said Aslan. "But there I have another name. You must learn to know me by that name." "This was the very reason why you were brought to Narnia, that by knowing me here for little, you may know me better there." Well, let us now proceed. And in that mythological imagery, he speaks to those of us in the church as well as those out. And he puts at the level of passion and feeling the kinds of things that we often talk about at the level of hidden. And I think the kinds of feelings he arouses enriches our experience. And I think deepens our commitment and our comprehension of the gospel. So I want to urge you on your campus to avail yourself of the genius of this great. And to have a kind of library that you put quickly into the hands of friends without whom you care, and whom you're trying to lead into the Christian experience. And touch all the places. And we've really gotten about a third of the books before us. There's some other super cheap things. And from beginning to end, a few things are more delightful than the Narnia series. By the way, if you would like to have a copy of my book on this, it's just going to have a print. I do have some copies available. If you want to, it's $5. And if some of you would like to have a copy, I'd be happy to send you one if you want to. Give me the money and your name and address before you leave. Okay, well, hope this has been profitable. And I hope now you've got at least a feel of what one style of apologetics is about. And I do hope that on various occasions we might cross paths. Okay?